Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Okay, so Saturday night tonight, but it's also following on after Upasika Day this afternoon. So it was a teaching day. Today we explored anatta. Of course, anatta is always a rich area of exploration, investigation, and of course extremely important from the Buddha's teachings. It's also one that tends to create easily a lot of speculation, proliferation, and of course that's not the purpose of it, but human beings being human beings are adept at finding things to proliferate about, have views and opinions about, and create suffering about. So we're quite good at that. And of course, that's one of the reasons why the Buddha, say, gave that teaching, is seeing that it's a skillful means for being able to cut through that suffering and complication that we tend to create. I remember Ajahn Chah just a very simple statement, but just that among the Buddhist teachings, anatta is the greatest method for overcoming suffering. And that's pretty high praise. So that to be able to reflect on and investigate it in a way that helps to overcome suffering, rather than creating more suffering. And there's nuances to this aspect of not-self. There's an idiom in the Pali language that kind of illustrates or just states what the this sense of self tends to do, and the idiom is the eye making, mind making, the underlying tendency to conceit, ahankara, mamankara, mananusaya. So it's something that we do. The eye making, we create that eye, especially in the English. We take something that wants to lie down, like just a thing, something just straight, and we prop it up and stand it up and hold the eye. Just like this, sort of eye. So we make it, we create it. Mind making, that sense of mind. This is mine. Mine. Isn't it in Nemo, the seagulls. Mine. The seagulls are fighting with each other. Mine. It's this great kids movie, but it's really, this is, that's it. And the mana is what is normally translated, it's translated as conceit. In the English language, conceit usually means thinking that you're better than somebody else. But from the Buddhist perspective, conceit is thinking that you're better than somebody, thinking that you're equal to somebody, thinking that you're worse than somebody, or that you're inferior to somebody. So that the position of being better, equal, inferior is conceit. Where do you stand? Which is, and there's the freedom. You don't have to clutter up the mind with all of those positions. So that sense of anatta is a way of both the understanding suffering and overcoming suffering. You know, one of these aspects, this aspect of mind. Remember, there's a really nice little story from the Christian tradition, Desert Fathers. These two Desert Fathers lived out in a, they lived incredibly simply. In those very early days of a practicing Christianity, they're very austere, and these two brothers, or Desert Fathers, monks, shared a cell together, and were incredibly harmonious, and were praised for their harmony, and got along together, practiced, did their prayers, and did what Desert Fathers do, and did their Christian practice, and one of them was saying, you know, we've lived together all these years, we practiced together all these years, and we've never had an argument. And you know, I've been studying about these things, and I've heard that others, normal people, get into arguments. And the other one said, oh, how do they do that? And he said, well, they just take something quite simple, say like this. And he said, well, like a brick. Here it is, this clock here. And you and say, that's mine. And then the other person disagrees and says, no, that's mine. And then they get into an argument. And they disagree. And so we could try that. and so then the one says, so he picks up the brick and says, this is mine. And the other says, oh no, that's mine. I said, well, if it's yours, take it. You know. So I never managed to get into an argument. never had a disagreement. It's this anatta, that mine is not so, you don't have to fuss over it. Ajahn Chah gave a very simple illustration of anatta. And he said, you know, it's just like if the phone rings and you don't pick it up. And it's that simple. You know, somebody was asking, you know, how do you understand anatta? I was thinking, oh, this is a really complex Buddhist, philosophical stance. And I just said, well, no, it's very simple. It's just, it's just like if the phone rings and you don't pick it up. And that's, that's exactly what it is, in the sense that from the perspective of, our mind, our experience, looks at or feels, okay, this is my body, these are my feelings, these are perceptions, memories, these are my thoughts and emotions, these are my consciousness. This is mine, this is who I am. It's like the phone ringing. If you pick it up and say, oh, this is my body, then it's yours. You've answered the phone. You have to talk to whoever it is. It could be some robo called, or you have this feeling of liking something or disliking something. You know, why do we pick it up? And if we just let it be, it doesn't mean that you don't have any. You don't have the experience of a body, or don't have the experience of feelings or thoughts or emotions, But you don't have to pick it up and get into an argument with it, or get caught in it, or have a view about it, or you know, it's the same with you hear the phone ring. I mean, that's what happens in, say, in my office anyway. Phone rings. I know the phone's ringing. But I don't pick it up. I know one monk who gets really frustrates him to no end. That he said, "You people don't pick up your phones." But it saves a lot of time. Pay attention to what you pick up, but you actually. Because that's we identify with it. We end up getting entangled in it. So that's that sense of self, that sense of this is who I am. And of course it haunts us and plagues us and creates a burden for us. So to be able to just sort of see, okay, this is body, this is feeling. Because a physical body is like this. Physical bodies, you know, they come in different shapes, sizes, ages. It's just a body. Feelings, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. They're not that diverse. They're not that complicated. Sometimes there's a pleasant feeling. Sometimes there's unpleasant. Sometimes they're neutral. We tend to, why is it like that? Well, it shouldn't be like that. What's it mean? And you create this incredible story, and it just was a feeling that arises. It'll be there for a while, and it'll pass away. It's not that big a deal. Perceptions of memories, assumptions, the imputing of a certain value to something. Those are something that the mind does. It's a function of the mind. But we don't have to pick it up as an identity or as something that we have to either argue with or support. It's just the way it is. Same with our thoughts and our emotions. Consciousness itself. But the habit is to create this, the eye-making, the mind-making, that underlying tendency to conceit. And that whole constellation of complications and problems, that is the self. Learning how to recognize how it works, what it does, how to use it skillfully, but then how to put it down, or how to not carry it. This particularly applies to the views and opinions, the kind of speculative views, ideas, concepts that we either get into arguments with, or we create confusion for ourselves, or that's kind of favoring and opposing. We take a stance and we assume of its rightness because it's our stance, and it ends up being in conflict with others. Or we take a stance and then we have a view, a particular view, and then we worry that whether it's right or wrong. It's because we've taken a stance. Doesn't mean we don't have any kind of, but it's that holding to it, assuming its solidity, rather than looking at its, how does that arise? How does that come into being? How does it establish itself? How does it actually pass away? That's the more important perspective to be attending to. But it doesn't usually happen that way. And so the views, I say from a Buddhist, say the scriptural perspective, or at the time of the Buddha, then there was a huge number of speculative views. Is the world eternal or is it not eternal? Is the world finite or is it infinite? Is the self the same as the body? Is the body different than the self or the soul? And then all the permutations of when an enlightened being dies, they're annihilated or they're eternal. There's both, neither. I mean, there's all these speculations around the kind of the world externally. And then this self, the soul, the idea of essence, and that speculation. And then one of the discourses that the Buddha gives, very first discourse in the Digha Nikaya, it goes into sort of 62 different speculative views around the world and the self. But it arises out of self. And there's an interesting discourse where there's a lay person at the time of the Buddha, very solid practitioner, accomplished meditator, Jitta the householder, and he was also he loved Dhamma discussion, and he'd invited a group of monks to have a meal, and before the meal offering, then he asked a question. He said, there's all these different views. Is the world eternal, not eternal, blah, blah, blah. And all these proliferations up to the all the 62 views of the that the Buddha gave in the Brahmajala Sutta. Where do these views come from? And of the group of monks that came, then the senior monk was silent, and next monk was silent, and then finally one of the more junior monks asked permission of the senior monk, could I answer that? And he said, yeah, go ahead. And so he said, his name was Isidatta. And he said, of these, all these speculative views, that end up in either propping up or refuting or complicating the experience of the world or the self, just come from identity view, the Sakkaya Ditti. And Sakkaya Ditti is the first fetter that is seen through, relinquished for the entry into the stream of Dhamma, into Sotapanna, Sotapatti. And of course, Jitta said, well, how does that work? Isidatta gives the standard kind of definition of how, because he asked, well, how does identity view come to be? And I said, if those views come out of identity, how does identity view come to be? And he gave the standard definition of how identity view comes into being, in that one takes form or the body as self, or that self possesses form, or that form or the body is in self, or there is self in form. And then it repeats itself for the five khandhas. So there's these different permutations of how we assume self or identity in these five aggregates of being, this body, this mind. And that and that's the basis for all the different, that generating of views and speculation and complication and proliferation. So that recognizing how that works is the way through that. In the sutta, the citta, the householder, asks Isidatta where he comes from. And Isidatta replies, he comes from Avanti, which is sort of like an outlying province and far away. And Citta, the householder, says, and I don't think he hadn't given his name yet. He said, I have a family friend who I've heard, I've never met yet, but it's through family and what I've heard that he's ordained. His name is Isidatta. Have you ever met him? And he said, yes. And, do you know where he lives? And then he was silent. And he said, are you Isidatta? And he said, yes. And he said, while you're living here, if there's any way I can help, be of service, look after you, provide requisites for you, then I'd love to be able to do that. And Isidatta says, that's very kind of you, householder. And monks had their meal, went back to the monastery. He packed up his requisites, his bowl, his robes, cleaned up his kuti, and continued wandering. Never came back. the image of the mendicant monastic who doesn't really entangle themselves. It's a very lovely, lovely, lovely sutta. So that this sense of identity view and how we create that internally, but also, we do that, the way that we label things, how we get caught in the labels, how we proliferate around it. Is it right or wrong? Do I like it? Do I dislike it? Should it be this way? Should it not be this way? All of the kinds of ways that we... Because it's important you look at these formulas that are in the suttas and you have to reflect on it. So what's that mean to my own experience? And how's that... how can we talk about it reflect on it for ourselves? So that seeing that tendency to identifying with some aspect of experience and then solidifying it, making it something solid, making it something so-called real for oneself. But that lands us in a place of carrying a burden. Ajahn Chah talks about a time when he was having a difficulty. He was having a recurring problem in his meditation. It's like his mind would get settled to a particular point and it would feel like he couldn't get past that. And he went and he heard about a disciple of Ajahn Mun who was living in a mountain hermitage. And he went and visited him and asked advice. In his practice, in his meditation. And he got some very good advice. The monk pointed to said the limits of perception, in the sense that we set up a boundary for ourselves, but it's a perceptual boundary. It's a perception. It's an assumption. So that Ajahn Chah reflected on that, worked with that. And he said that when he came down from that hermitage and continued his wandering. So the first place he stopped was at another little, probably an abandoned monastery or an empty hermitage. And he said it was at that point he sort of realized that how we label things, what we call them, are really constructs. And he gave the example of ordinary things. This is a kettle, this is a spittoon. But they're not intrinsically that. But he said, but reflecting on that and seeing, well, that's the same for all of our, this is my body, these are my feelings, this is who I am. These are constructs. You know, we can obviously, when you have need of a kettle, it's handy to have a kettle. In the same way, we need to use our body, we need to use and rely on our thoughts and feelings, our emotions. But we tend to solidify them, identify with them, carry them around, and create problems with them. So that sense of that insight into anatta is an opportunity to see the constructed nature of the things that seem so solid and to be able to see through them. And of course that's the literal translation, say, of vipassana, is to see through. So like seeing through that construct of self, seeing through the construct of what we call world, self, others. And it's not that they're not there, but they're understood. And so when they're understood, they cease to be a problem, cease to be a source of suffering. So that to be able to pick up these ordinary things, body, feeling, perceptions, mental formations, this is incredibly ordinary. Pick them up, see their constructed nature, and to not create a problem of it. It's like with, phone rings, you don't have to pick it up. It's sort of quite ordinary. And somebody says, this is mine. You say, okay, it's yours, fine. It's not a source of difficulty or a problem. And this is the freedom that the Buddha gives us the opportunity to touch. It's not some sort of airy-fairy, philosophical, otherworldly thing. This is really very much to do with how we live, how we experience, how we relate to ourselves and the world around us. And we can do it without suffering. To offer that for reflection this evening.